Accession number 14157, reel 2.
Commander Caulfield, reel 2.
The Heinkel came over and made one more pass, probably having a good look at us, and then disappeared. And I decided that the best thing to do would be to swim to the shore, which must have been about half a mile away. The water was extremely cold. I had damaged my back some in the crash into the sea, and I set off to swim on my back because I had the May West. In the old days, you just had a capok May West with a tube with which you blew the thing up, and I had made an effort to blow it up. You had to unscrew a nozzle on the end of a rubber tube, blow it up, and then screw the nozzle up again. I was having trouble with my hands, which were very cold, trying to unscrew the nozzle. When I got it unscrewed, the cold was such that I couldn't draw in enough air to blow the thing up. But the capok part of it kept me afloat, and I'd done a few strokes of swimming on my back when the aircraft sank. And shortly afterwards, a naval airman Hill popped up to the surface. So I went back to where the wreckage was, and he had been very obviously wounded in the head, although he was conscious, and he couldn't swim. So I got hold of the back of his May West and set off for the shore. And I'm really not quite sure how long I was in the water, but I then remember seeing these two men running down to the foreshore and getting into a rowing boat and coming and picking us up, picking us both up out of the water. And my memory is then very hazy about what happened. I can remember being transferred to a typical Norwegian putt-putt fishing boat, diesel-driven boat, who transferred us to a naval auxiliary, Norwegian naval auxiliary. And one of the seamen in this naval auxiliary vessel had a Liverpudlian wife, and he spoke very good English, came to see me in the hospital in Tromsø afterwards. So I was put ashore. I was there for about 3 hours, but he did tell me one story, and that was the captain of the naval auxiliary shouted down to the fishing boat, "Are they English or are they German? And if they're German, throw them back." And I don't know if it was the fisherman or this chap who was by this time trying to lift me onto the Norwegian auxiliary, said, "How do you feel?" To which I replied, "Fucking frozen." But he said, "He's English." So I don't always knock that word too much. But anyway, I then went ashore was put ashore in the hospital in Tromsø, where my head was stitched up. And unfortunately, Naval Airman Hill died in the auxiliary on the way to Tromsø, and he's still buried there. Well, he was buried there by the ship's company of Devonshire. The ship was in Tromsø. The word was sent out to the ship. The young doctor from the Devonshire came ashore and picked me up and took me back on board. I rejoined my own ship. Unfortunately, I lost all my clothes because they were taken off when I was stripped. I never got there. I came back on board in a blanket, a number of blankets, really. And that was on the 17th of May. And on the 25th, 8 days later, Petty Officer Parsons arrived, came up from Harstad, where 8 walrus had been disembarked and were flying from Harstad, doing patrols from Harstad. He brought one of them up and joined the ship, and I see the next time I flew was on the 25th of May.
Just going to go back to the incident.
Yeah.
You described how you got out of the plane. Had it begun to sink by then?
Oh, it was underwater, yes, because it when it hit the surface, the I would imagine that the engine broke loose. The engine was above the aircraft, between the wings. The engine would have been detached because when I got to the surface, the wings had been torn off. There was the tail sticking up, some of the wings, and that was about all sticking up out of. But when it sank, the wings were still attached to the aircraft. They sank. The wingtip floats went down with it. Otherwise, I would have had something to hang on to.
You must have thought that you weren't going to get out.
Well, there wasn't any real thinking done. I suppose I was unconscious, and the cold water brought me to. I couldn't have been unconscious for all that long, otherwise I would have been full of water. But when I came to and saw the hole there, the circle of light at least, I was very glad to get out, certainly.
In the plane, you said that you were hosing the Heinkel.
Yeah.
Could you see the effect of your bullets?
Oh, yes, because we were had tracer bullets there, and we were hitting it repeatedly. And unfortunately, Hill had a very obvious head wound. He got that fairly early on, and he wasn't doing an awful lot of firing. And at one point, I went back from the forward gun position to the after gun position and brought two more magazines up to the front gun with me, two Lewis gun magazines up to the front gun with me. But I was wasting an awful lot of ammunition, more or less sighting by firing, just a quick burst to see where the tracer was, and then aim a little bit further ahead or after, whatever.
But could the walrus outmaneuver the Heinkel?
Yes. At every pass it made, we tried to turn underneath it, and the first one to stop firing was they had an under gunner. I didn't see much from him later. I think that Benson Dare in this, when the upper wing dissolved in a sheet of flame and a loud roar, I think that the same burst of gunfire that started that blaze also hit Benson Dare, which caused us just to nose forward and just go straight into the sea. We had no height because basically we kept low down on the water so that we always had the advantage that he couldn't get underneath us or behind us. It was always above us.
What kind of reception did you get when you got back to the Devonshire?
Was sort of reception one would expect, really, what happened and the report what had happened, and everybody was extremely sad that, of course, that we'd lost two people.
You said that you resumed flying, I think, on the 25th?
25th was the next flight, I said, yes.
What did that constitute?
Sorry, pause. Well, right. I see that the ship then went up to Kirkness again, and we were doing anti-submarine patrols ahead of the ship into Kirkness, and then from there the surrounding fjords, and from there on the 26th we went to Hammerfest, and did much the same up there. I see that we did three patrols out of Hammerfest. But at the time, this was the end of May, the airfield that the Fleet Air Arm flew from was a frozen lake. We had a squadron, there were skuas ashore, and there was a squadron of gladiators ashore flying from a frozen lake. Well, of course, by May or June, the lake wasn't going to be frozen any longer. And we looked all the way around northern Norway for possible sites. I can remember looking for sites for airfields to see if there was any flat enough area there from which to fly fighter aircraft. We didn't really find any. Oh, and reading the history of the Fleet Air Arm the other day, it wasn't a history of the Fleet Air Arm, it was Admiral Gibson's book, Hall Taught in Belay, an excellent book. You probably...
I've tape recorded him.
You have?
Yes.
He's a delightful man, lovely man. But as he pointed out, at the end of the Norwegian campaign, the Fleet Air Arm had lost about a third of its aircraft and a third of its people by the end of the campaign in skuas mostly. They were lost, and there were the Glorious was sunk. The Devonshire, my ship, we brought King Haakon and the royal family and everybody, and many of the Norwegian Parliament, a lot of Norwegian Air Force and Army officers, and a number of British soldiers back from Norway. And we came back from Tromsø. We came back, we exceeded the speed, the Devonshire exceeded the speed which she had done on trials, the speed trial, when she was first commissioned in 1927. We really were hurrying to get back because of the precious cargo we had on board. And with tremendous regret, we went within about 12 miles of where the Glorious was being sunk by the two German ships. And there was nothing whatsoever that we could do about it.
Did you see the action?
No, we didn't see the action. I was told that a lookout reported sighting a masthead on the horizon. You know, in very clear weather, you could see just that much of a mast sticking up over the horizon, that a masthead was seen. We received the Glorious alarm report on the radio, which was the last signal they ever sent, giving their position. And it affected... I was told many, many years later it affected Admiral Cunningham greatly that we did not go to their help or pick anybody up, but he had received a personal letter from Winston Churchill to say that in your position I would have done exactly the same, and you are not to feel that any blame attaches to you that no survivors were picked up. But I only learned that within the last 10 years. There was a chap called Dean, H.K. Dean, who became a great friend of mine, joined the ship as a paymaster cadet in Tromsø. And we met each other many times since, and his daughter is married and lives in Sorkham now. So I saw a lot of Dixie in later years as well. He's just died, regrettably.
What were your next duties after the Glorious incident, please? Which would be June 1940.
June 1940. I better keep it open at the page and then I won't waste time looking for it. We went out to Halifax. There was a convoy out to Halifax. Then back to Scarpa, I see, in July, doing just general patrols and working with the ship. August, again, where are we? We're down to back in the 4th again now. We did some northern patrols, and then at the end of August we set sail and went out for that abortive attempt to take Dakar in Senegal and in West Africa, which was an absolute bloody shambles. Again, Dixie Dean was, he joined the Admiral's staff, and discussing it later, I've got a book on it, I can't remember the name, Operation, anyway, whatever it was, the attempt to take Dakar. So many things were misconceived. The idea of taking Dakar and stopping the Germans using it as a submarine base, when they would have been able to cover all the convoys round to the Cape and everything else, was a brilliant idea. If they had been able to use that as a submarine, a U-boat refueling base, it would have been absolutely catastrophic. But the French there were not on either side, so to speak. They were not Vichy French. They just weren't going to join in with anybody. And this attempt to take Dakar was mounted. We took General de Gaulle and I think something like 6,000 Frenchmen out there in troop ships, and a very large British expeditionary force to go out there as well. We were going to bombard the place and then put the troops ashore. At the end of the planning thing in London for this operation, they had a dinner in a public restaurant. It was a Connaught Rooms type of restaurant where they stood up and drank toast to the success of the operation, which was one bit of brilliance. The other thing was that all the operation orders were in bin liner type bags when they were being loaded on board the ships. And I believe that was in Chatham that this occurred, although the Devonshire never went to Chatham. One of the bags was dropped and burst open, and the secret operation orders were blowing round the dockyard at Chatham for anybody to pick up. I was told on the way out there by Lieutenant Commander Crease, the staff operations officer, what we were going to do and where we were going, and that was no breach of any secrecy, because we would see the whole time. There was no rewind, you know. That was fine. The operation orders were then ordered. But the Devonshire was our target. The Devonshire's target was going to be large batteries on Cape Manuel, which was the southern tip of the little peninsula at Dakar. And instead of doing naval spotting, I told you that we spent July and August doing various exercises. This was practicing 8-inch firing and doing spotting for the guns and so on. A completely foreign way of doing spotting of gunfire and reporting it back to the ship. We were given celluloid circles to stick onto a map, and I had to name a segment of this from this celluloid thing as where the shot had fallen, instead of doing a perfectly easy naval method of spotting, which was just to give short, over, left or right. And the ship then made the corrections, which we'd practiced for hours on end, and was a very good way of doing it, which was adopted by the army. There were then the RAF and the army, there were various ways of doing it, clock code and over, short, and one of the RAF methods was actually telling the guns what to do, up, so and so. But the naval method was the one that everybody preferred. And I was getting all these charts out with which we had been issued, French charts, and made the discovery on the way out there that the celluloid overlays which we'd been given for the charts were on a completely different scale from the charts. And we were going to be reporting gunfire in yards, and all these charts were metric, of course, because they were French charts. So thank God we reverted to, we'll say we'll just do naval bombardment spotting and leave it at that. The French were very crafty, very clever, in that they had a battleship there, the Richelieu, which had been disabled by a party from HMS Hermes, who'd gone in there in a motorboat at night, dropped depth charges underneath the stern with long fuses, and then got out of the harbour. The depth charges had gone off and damaged either the propeller or the steering of the Richelieu, so she couldn't put to sea. The French had had the Richelieu, the stern, towed out into the harbour, and an anchor dropped to give them the maximum cone of fire from their guns, from the Richelieu, the 16-inch, I think there were 16-inch guns in the Richelieu, which were fired to great effect. They had one or two cruisers there which had escaped from the Mediterranean, which that awful court-martial of the admiral at, whose name escapes me temporarily, who was at Gibraltar in allowing them to go. What was his name?
Doesn't matter, it's on record.
No, it's on yes, it's on record. And they went down to Dakar, and when the operation was taking on in Dakar Bay, it wasn't called Dakar Bay, I haven't got it down here, but in that particular bay there was a whole lot of neutral shipping who'd gone in there. They couldn't get back to their own countries. Were anchored in the bay there, and when the Ark Royal was out there, was part of the force, the Ark Royal, when they took off to torpedo these cruisers, the cruisers dodged around in amongst all this neutral merchant shipping, and of course you couldn't drop the torpedoes because they were very cleverly putting neutral ships in between the aircraft and themselves. Hardly cricket, but then again, quite crafty. We lost aircraft Swordfish from the Ark Royal dive bombing. They took captive the emissaries that were the French emissaries that were sent ashore and landed on the airfield. They tried to capture the Swordfish that landed them, but fought them off and took off again and got back to the Ark Royal. They lost Skua dive bombers. They lost Swordfish in the torpedo attacks. The Australia, HMS, the Australian cruiser, was there. I watched their walrus being shot down by a Hawk, Curtis Hawk, with aircraft which the Americans had sold to the French. They had fighters ashore there. During the bombardment, a French submarine, I don't have the name here, torpedoed the Barham, as you were, the Resolution. We had the Resolution and the Barham there. The admiral was in the Resolution, transferred his flag to the Barham after the torpedoing. She had to go across the States to be... And I can't remember the name of the submarine, but I was right above it when I saw the torpedoes fired, sent out an alarm report, which was received that the torpedoes had been fired at the Resolution and Barham. The Barham did a superb job of avoiding them, considering the age of the Barham, that the captain did a wonderful job of dodging them. The Resolution did not managed to avoid them and was hit amidships, but they had the old-fashioned torpedo blisters on the side, which just caused a heavy list I went on board the Resolution in Freetown afterwards, and all the upper decks had been sanded because she was over at about 12 to 15 degrees, and the sand, everybody was walking around on board at an angle of 15 degrees while still trying to pretend that they were a battleship, you know, the white uniforms and all the rest of it. I had friends on board the Resolution. And then...
Anything else you personally saw at Dhaka apart from the firing of those torpedoes?
I was on board the ship when we were later bombardments, and we were being fired at by these batteries ashore, and a television video was released, which Dixie Dean got hold of and showed down here, which was a lot of the camera work was the British ships actually under fire from these shore batteries, which was interesting, seeing my own ship under fire, it was rather like sitting outside oneself, watching something, seeing it on a film. I'd never seen it before. And the French heavy batteries, so that they could spot their fall of shot, when they were trained out to sea, so the shells were designed to be fired at ships. So when they hit the water, one battery, the water, as the water spouts went up, would be coloured pink. And another battery would be blue, and another one would be a bright green, which I think it made being shot at very interested, because all the HA gun crews on the upper deck was a sort of great, ooh, went up, there's a pink one, you know, there's a blue one, there's a green one. Fortunately, they were firing at the battleships, not at us, which made it much more interesting, because one could stand and have a grandstand view of it all going on. I say nobody was hit by the gunfire, but having seen all these orders and this, I sent the whole lot off. I had every signal that was sent while all this was going on, including one which was sent by the French, picked up in the flagship, and we got a copy on our bridge, and it translated roughly. The French had said, unless you retire 20 nautical miles, which would be 20 mille marin, was translated by somebody who didn't speak very good French on the bridge of, we have 20,000 marines in Dhaka, which caused a few wry smiles. But then General de Gaulle, a very brave, undoubtedly, whatever he was, a very brave, his personal gallantry was beyond dispute, went in one of the first boats to take the French ashore, and you can see General de Gaulle standing in the front of a boat with a drawn sword, ready to go and recapture a part of France. But the French were decidedly hostile towards this landing, and while General de Gaulle, I'm quite sure, was still standing up in the bow of the boat, I kept this signal for years, and I bundled the whole lot up, including the leaflets that were dropped by the aircraft ashore at Dhaka, to asking them to give up. He sent a signal to say that he refused to be a party to a fight between Frenchmen. And my instant reaction was, well, what the bloody hell have we brought 6,000 French soldiers out here for? Does he expect all the British soldiers to go in and do it? But by which time